Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my fan friends. How you doing? Welcome to another Hullerstubber this week with Greg Jenner. A few things going on. My Radio 4 sitcom Relativity has begun. There will be 6 episodes. The first one's gone out all right. Ready? You can listen to it on Fridays at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Or just go to your BBC Sounds app or on your computer, and you can listen to whatever's out there. There is also a way to listen to the first 2 series, but it is illegal. You can check my Twitter feed and my blog for the link. And also, I have a new book coming out that I've more or less finished writing now. It'll be out on November the 5th. It's called The Problem with Men, When's International Men's Day and Why That's Important, or something like that, Why That Matters. It's about my International Men's Day, Women's Day, Men's Day marathon, but also asking other questions about masculinity and toxic masculinity and working out whether we can get to the point where we celebrate International Men's Day properly or whether we need to. It's very good. I think you'll enjoy it. What I'm saying is go and pre-order it, preferably from one of the bigger outlets, so that the numbers start to count, everyone gets excited, and then they put loads of them in the shops. It's out on Amazon. I'm sure it's on Waterstones and wherever else you get your books. You can buy it from Go Faster Stripe or an independent book provider later in the day if you would prefer to do that. There will be an audiobook read by little me, Richie Herring, that should be available to pre-order either now or pretty soon as well. If you feel like doing that, that would be terrific. You can get it on Kindle as well, obviously, and all that stuff. I've worked hard on it. I think you'll like it. It's funny, but it's also interesting. I've worked pretty hard on it. Anyway, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Hullerstubber with Gregory Jenner. Hello and welcome. Please welcome a man who's just had a shower. That's why his hair looks like it's been cut. It hasn't been cut. It's Richard Herring. Hello, here I am wearing my trademark 2 pairs of spectacles. That's just the kind of guy I am. Welcome to another remote Richard Herring's Lying Shitty Tories podcast. That's pretty much self-explanatory. If you're listening in the future, when this goes out on the podcast stream, I think you could probably guess what week this went out, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's still a story, and I would be very surprised if Dominic Cummings has resigned in 2 months' time or ever, and might just be the president of the United Kingdom anyway. But I was hanging around at the Specsavers at Barnard Castle the other day, and the man who does the eye tests, he calls it Rahulastapa, so I don't know if that's going to... Oh, yeah, everyone's chatting out. How lovely. I don't know if that's going to catch on. So... welcome to the show. Sorry we weren't here last week. I mean, we were for you at home who aren't seeing this live. I am sort of trying to write a book at the moment, and I was a bit ill last week as well, not with anything serious. Well, I hope it was something serious, but if it was, I got through it really easily, and it's pimpsy. I was just a bit tired. So it's lovely to be back. I might fall asleep. I was just saying to our guest, I might fall asleep during the podcast as I am. It's a bit hard trying to write a book in these circumstances, I am finding, but we're getting there. I'm 14,000 words into a 20,000 word book. Should be able to finish it by the end of the week. That's the plan. And then you just send it off and it's fine. They just go, yeah, we'll print that. And that's fine. That's how it works, as I understand it. What's been going on since we last met you here? Apart from me being ill and tired. I had fun today with Lord Sugar, who turns out is a real idiot, a complete idiot. I had so much respect for him before, as you know. Very famous Tottenham Hotspur fan, as our guest is today. Retweeted a GIF that's saying, "Happy birthday. Today, every person in the whole world is the same age." That can't be true, can it? "Today is a very special day. There's only one chance this happens every 1,000 years. Your age this year and your year of birth, the total for every person is 2020. So if you add your age to the year of your birth, you will get 2020. It's so strange that even experts can't explain it." I mean, I don't, maybe experts in any other field than mathematics. But even then, I think it'd be weird. "You figure out and see if it's 2020. It's a 1,000-year wait. Take a shot. Let everyone calculate it." Well, mine adds up to 2019 because I'm 52, so it doesn't work. What it should have said is they could have made it even better. The last second of the year, everyone, if you add their age to the year of their birth, for 1 second, we'll all be 2020. That's not how old we are. That is just the maths. And so, Lord Sugar doesn't seem to understand that if you add your age to the year you're born, that gives you this year. He seems to think it's magic. It did lead me to, for some reason, trying to suggest to Lord Sugar different catchphrases he could use if he's got bored of "you are fired." My favourite one was, "Please leave now. You were never employed here. That's the whole point of the program." I think it'd be better if he did that as he left instead. So we had some fun with Lord Sugar's stupidity today. He doesn't seem to realise how quite a lot of people are amazed by that fact. We'll find out if our guest is later. Also, the news this week, I don't know if you saw this news. Scientists have created a mouse embryo, which is 4% human. And that begs the question, doesn't it? What percentage of a human would a mouse have to be before it was no longer considered morally wrong to have sex with it? It's less than 100%. That's all I know. We're 3% Neanderthal, but no one gets sent to prison for bestiality after having sex with a monkey every time you have sex with a human. So there must be a mouse percentage that is acceptable of how much human you inject into the mouse. And then it's actually okay to have. I don't want to have sex with a mouse. I'm not sick. I'm not that Hollywood actor that you're all thinking about. I want to have sex with a woman with realistic mouse ears, whiskers and a tail. Plenty of people do that with people dressed up as a mouse, I'm guessing. So it's doing it with someone who's been specifically bred to look like that all the time. Really, any more morally questionable? Who's the real sick man in this so-called society? I would only require that the chimera that I had sex with had the right bits of mouse and woman, because I don't want to order it in advance, get it delivered, and it turns out that it's a giant mouse with just human mammary glands. I don't want that. I would expect a discount if that's what's turned out. I would take it in out of the goodness of my human heart and I would have sex with it, but I would want to pay less money for that. There are a lot of moral questions about scientists playing God with genetics, but you'd be very naive if you thought the main one isn't about creating sexy hybrids between different species and where the percentage cuts off of acceptability lie. Anyway, that's what I spent most of the week thinking about rather than writing my book. So time well spent, I think. Let's see what else. My daughter's been writing stories about poo. I won't bother. You can read my blog if you want to find out about that, but I'm very proud of her. She had wrote a story about a poo that pooed another poo and that pooped, and then those poos fell in love, and had a family. It's incestuous. I'm not sure what the legality of that is. But anyway, let's see. So thanks for watching. If you're watching live on Twitch, then we're doing this pretty much every Wednesday, 8 o'clock. They will go out as podcasts down the line. If you're enjoying them and you'd like to contribute to our empire, You can give us free money via, if you're an Amazon Prime member, you get £5 every month, which you can donate to us. You can subscribe and Ian Amazon will give us £5. Then they'll take back £1.50 because he's an idiot, but he's still giving us £3.50 every month, which you can give us for free. You can subscribe with money if you want. If you want to spend money on the podcast, the best thing is to become a monthly badger. You get loads of cool stuff, including this presentation wallet. Reminds me of something. I don't know what. You get bad. This is the gold badge. You get a special little membership thing. I'm one of the cool kids, and there's a secret code in there. There's the rules of Rahalastapa. The first rule of Rahalastapa Club is you must shout Rahalastapa whenever anyone else says Rahalastapa, wherever you are. So you should be doing it now. The second rule of Rahalastapa Club is to be cool at all times. The third rule of Rahalastapa is when called upon by Richard Herring, I will do anything that he commands. Anything! And the fourth rule of Rahalastapa is that it's really helpful if you talk about Rahalastapa, because most people don't seem to know what it is. So that's the kind of thing you can get. I've just given away all the rules, but there's loads more in that little leaflet. Plus, you get extras, backstage interviews. I've just done one with the guest that you can only see if you're a monthly badger. So why not go and do that if you've enjoyed this stuff during lockdown? But there's loads of stuff on Twitch that I'm doing at the moment. I presume I'll still be doing some of it wherever we are in lockdown. I play snooker in the evenings at 7:30 most nights, and I stone clear every weekday. Out on the fields, and you can watch that usually about 8 a.m., depending what time the kids wake up and how much, you know, responsibility I have with my human family that I've spawned in order to cover up the fact that I'm a secret stone clearer. Don't tell my wife what I'm doing. Anyway, let's crack on. My guest this week, he's been on before. He's probably best known, though, for playing an historian in The Horrible Histories, the movie Rotten Romans. Will you please welcome the incredible Greg Jenner? Here he is. There he is. Hooray. Everyone's cheering and saying hooray. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks. Yeah, not too bad. I mean, it's been up and down over the last few weeks, but I'm kind of on and up, I think, at the moment.
That's good.
How about you? You're getting through?
Just about. I've got a 9-month-old baby who, she's taking a very tangential approach to sleep and the concept of it. So that's not ideal. But apart from that, she's very nice.
That would be happening anyway. So, you know, you'd be pretty much stuck in the house anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, you're the luckiest man in the world.
In a way.
I saw Horrible Histories, the movie. I enjoyed it very much.
It's very silly. It's a fun, silly...
Lots of good songs.
It's got songs, it's got dancing, it's got Romans, it's got Celts. I mean, what else do you want?
Nick Frost. It's got Nick Frost in it, which means that I didn't get the part. If he hadn't accepted that, then I'm next in line for all of Nick Frost's roles.
That is how it works,
But he gets, you know, he does take all the work, so I don't get any acting.
I mean, he was very good in it. And
he was extremely good.
But, yeah, if he'd had an accident with a javelin or something, we would have phoned you.
I could have given it a go. And how was it? I know you've made some cameos. You've been obviously heavily involved in Horrible Histories all the way through.
Yeah.
And you have done some cameo work on the TV show.
I love the way you call it work.
How was it being a movie star for a day and playing... is it Emperor Nero's historian?
I'm Emperor Nero's personal historian, which is an in-joke that nobody got, which delighted me. My mum got it and nobody else. But it was very fun. I got to go to Bulgaria, which I've been to before, but it was very nice. Yeah. And the weird thing about it was that I was meant to stand at the top of a staircase and watch Craig Roberts playing Nero fall down this staircase and be caught by a stunt team. It's a proper staircase, and he really fell and he landed on a mat. And every time he did it, I just freaked out at the kind of genuine terror of what was happening in front of me. I was meant to be playing it sort of slightly cool, but he was literally falling from quite a height down a staircase onto a mat and doing it in sort of stupid kind of Roman sandals and a big Roman kind of cape almost. And every time he did it, I just thought, oh my God, he's going to die. So the take that you see in the movie is the one time when I didn't go, oh my God, are you okay? So, yeah.
So did he have to do it a lot because you were reacting wrong? Did they make him do it again and again because of you?
They did it a lot, I think, to get the best shot. But I was acutely aware that I was probably ruining some of the scenes because, you know, I have no training. And also, this is a this is not a stuntman. This is just a nice man who fell down the stairs a lot. And it felt dangerous. But I'm sure he was fine. I mean, he was fine. He was very, very kind of like matter of fact about it. A very impressive performer. But yeah. I was scared. So yeah, you can watch that film. It's free on Amazon Prime. If you've got Amazon Prime,
that's where I saw it.
It's £0. You can watch it 1,000 times.
So. Yeah, and if you've got Amazon Prime, don't forget to link your accounts to Twitch and give us £5
as well. Ian Amazon's a very generous man.
Yeah. He's lovely, isn't he? All you have to do is give him £80 or £90 a year, and he'll give you £60 to give back to me. That's insane. Anyway, what percentage of human would a mouse have to be before it was considered morally wrong to have sex with it? In your historical, as a historian. Oh, I've just dropped the book.
Well, I mean, famously, this was the first draft of Frankenstein. This is what, you know, Mary Shelley's, right. Her early work, before she sort of really nailed down what the book was about, she initially was thinking, you know, writing a story about a mad scientist who tries to create the perfect sexy mouse. And it goes wrong. And the mouse, you know, basically wreaks vengeance upon her and upon the people of the village. But,
I mean, that's the danger. That's the danger.
That's what happens.
There is a risk because you can't, you know, I guess you'd really have to be good at genetics. Also, is the question because, like, I wouldn't be above board. And if it's a mainly a human, if you're creating it from an embryo, if it's mainly human, you would have to wait, you know, I think, you know, morally speaking, at least 20 years before you had sex with it. And you would have to say, are you okay with me having sex with
you?
I think you'd have, to make maybe 100. I'll be 73 by the time the mouse is ready, and the mouse human will be 20. I think maybe 100 of those mouse humans would be up for it. So I think you'd have to make a big army of them. Some of them would turn out how you wanted, maybe 1,000 of them. And then to get everything morally okay is what I'm saying. But if it's mainly mouse, then an adult mouse, you're going to have to wait about a year for that, don't you? So but then that would be better.
The consent there is much harder to get if it's mainly mouse, I think.
But they're still human, so there's still a point, a percentage where it's mainly mouse, but human enough to be able to say yes or no, but also mouse enough that it's an adult when it's
what is that percentage? Because I'm worried here about the ethics.
Well, that's
Richard.
Why you've got to work it out. That is an ethical minefield, but that's, I think you have to think, but I'm you know, I'm not a sick person. I've thought very carefully.
Because, like, you know, if you look at like a spork, you know, half spoon, half fork. You'd say that's probably 50-50. And so you are saying that's equal parts of a spoon and fork.
So is that okay to have sex with?
Well, that feels to me like it's a thing where you've gone, yes,
okay,
this has become. So I'm thinking 50-50 might be where at least you can start to have that conversation.
And how much 50-50 do you think it would look like? 50-50, do you think it would look like a mouse with ears and stuff on it, with human ears? Or do you think like a human that was a bit... Because there's a thing where, you know, if you Google... Someone sent me an image of like a woman dressed as a sexy mouse. That is a thing. It's actually not one of my things. That's
amazingly
not
enough, not one of the many things.
But it's obviously the thing for. I'm actually very vanilla. But it's obviously a thing for something. The idea of a woman with ears.
Yeah.
And she was wearing a little bow tie and a sort of rah-rah skirt. That ruins it for me because a mouse does not wear those things. So I get rid of the bow tie. But it's a woman, with a mouse ears,
okay,
whiskers, and a big mouse tail. And obviously, to some people, that is a sexy idea.
So the tail, you're enjoying the tail. Do you think that's...
I'm not enjoying it, Greg. Don't turn this on me. I'm a perfectly normal man who just wants to create, just out of interest. Is it cheating on your partner to have sex with something that is 50% mouse? There's half of it's a rodent. Half of it's a human being.
I think that is cheating, yes. And I also think that's probably illegal and wrong and also very strange.
Okay. It's just interesting to get your history and historical opinion about it.
Does Mickey Mouse have a tail?
Why go for Mickey? Why not go for Minnie? Why have you gone straight in for Mickey Mouse?
Because I can't visualize...
I have all the choices of mice.
I'm struggling to visualize any sort of bipedal mouse other than Mickey. Mickey's the only one I can think of. But I can't remember, does Mickey have a tail? And you've gone to the tail, the ears, and the whiskers.
Well, you know, you're struggling to visualise any other mouth. I can't. It's very insulting that you've done this if you've listened to any of the podcasts recently, because I am actually incapable of visualising anything. I keep forgetting the name of it, but my mind's eye is blind.
Okay.
I can't picture anything visual in my head. So thanks for bringing that up when I wasn't going to talk about it. My disability that I can't visualise anything. So I don't know if he's got a tail because I am... Because I can't see it. I'll tell you what I can do, though, is I can Google Mickey Mouse.
Yes, please do.
And look at him and see if he's got a tail. I'll just do that for you now. Yeah, of course he's got a tail. He's got that little thin tail, hasn't he? There he is. I don't know if I can show you him legally. I won't do just in case I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Mickey Mouse.
Well, that's...
I'll put a picture.
All right. So I guess
you... So he's got a tail, but he also wears red pants and big yellow shoes. He's got deformed, massive feet and hands for some reason. He doesn't have whiskers. He does have the ears, but to me, they're too... they're too comically, like, they're not really mouse ears. They're these round...
No, they're sort of satellite dishes, aren't they?
Whereas Minnie Mouse, who I would have personally chosen...
Right.
She has... she's wearing a dress, so it's hard to see. Maybe she's got a bow in her hair, so you can't really see her ears. I mean, to be honest, I think Minnie Mouse might just be Mickey Mouse in drag, which is fine.
That's okay.
But I wish Walt Disney was just open about it, because it's not good. But there we go. Okay, well, I listened to your Dead to Me, which is a fantastic podcast about history, very entertaining. I've been on it as well, so I'm not just listening to. I listened to that one.
You
I was
did.
In the
you
room.
Listened. You were there.
It was about Stonehenge. I'm interested in stones. But I listened. Was it with Sarah Pascoe you were talking about Neanderthals?
No, Boudica.
Who was the Neanderthal? Because I listened to the Neanderthal one as well.
Tim Minchin
one was great.
There's Tim Minchin on Neanderthals, yes, and we had a lovely
good
chat.
Choice because he is. He is probably out of all the people you could have... Is that why you went for him?
He chose it. We asked him, what did he fancy? And he said, I'd like Neanderthals, please. And luckily, I know a Neanderthal expert, Becky Rank-Sykes, who's a brilliant specialist with a brand new book coming out very soon. So it was a match made in heaven. And we had a very, very long, incredibly nerdy, brilliant chat. It was about 2 hours long. And we cut it down to about 45 minutes. But it was genuinely... I felt very stupid at every point because it's two brilliantly clever people in a room going, yeah, of course. Well, cerebral cortexes are famously unreliable. And I'd be like, sure.
He'd done a lot of research. You're not meant to research before you go in as the comedian. And he'd done a lot of research. So, I knew a little bit. But that's quite interesting that we've got this 2 to 4% of...
Yeah.
Human, well, of European, is it mainly, or is it not? It's not African people, is it?
If your heritage is primarily European, then it's 2 to 4%, probably more closer to 2.5%. There is a sort of there is some Neanderthal DNA still floating about in us right now.
So, at some point in the past, someone made a moral decision. And they decided to. I mean, is that? It's hard to know, isn't it? But who was the higher evolved species between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens? It's difficult to...
And what do you measure? Are you measuring intelligence? Are you measuring linguistic skills? Are you measuring aptitude for hunting? Are you measuring, hotness in terms of the kind of physical attractiveness? Historically, you would say that in terms of the way that they've been constructed, Neanderthals were often said to be stupid and thuggish and, dragging people around like wheelie bins and sort of shouting at the moon. And the evidence increasingly is saying, probably not, actually. Probably pretty smart, intelligent, probably had some language, may have had some sort of musical capacity, might have done art, we're not sure, but certainly symbolic language and symbolic meaning and all of these things that we think of as uniquely human, well, maybe not.
And they were here before Homo sapiens. Is that correct? Neanderthals, they were in Europe quite a long time before us.
Yeah, they were. So the Neanderthals were primarily in Europe long before us. And then we sort of arrived in and gradually sort of outperformed them, probably. We're not quite sure why. But
fucked them to death, I think. They couldn't keep up with us. It was us fucking them. It's not fucking us. We're just trying to create music and art and stuff.
Exactly. We're relentlessly horny. But yes, we're not entirely sure why they die out.
As an historian, if a Neanderthal was found,
like
frozen in a block of ice, and they thawed out and it was alive, would you have sex with the Neanderthal just out of academic interest?
Just out of doing my empirical research? I think I'd probably do some heavy petting. I think I'd probably go maybe a bit of touching, maybe a little bit of frottage. But
I'd give it a crack, and so to speak. And I could say to your wife or partner, I'd have to do it out of research. I'm just interested to see, just to find out how it works.
Yeah, I mean,
if the Neanderthal consented as well, that's very important.
That's very important, absolutely. And Neanderthals were. Strong and powerful, I'm sure. Yeah. A very impressive lover. Much more so than me.
Well, I can find that out. There's one thing I can find out, and that is that. That's possible, though unlikely, I would say. We're going to talk about your book, but I will talk about other stuff first. You've been doing this homeschool history, which I haven't. My kids are a bit too young for it. I think my wife listened to it and said it's a bit too advanced for a five-year-old.
Yeah, it's probably seven or eight is roughly the right age to sort of switch on. It's a little bit... we talk a bit about, you know, beheadings and executions and murders and stuff like that, but it's a kid's show, but it's Radio 4, it's a podcast, it's for the kids, but it's also for the families, and it's an emergency podcast. The BBC asked us to make incredibly short notice, and so we did, and it was it's been fun. It's just a 15-minute history lesson by me, and I we do silly sound effects over the top, and I co-wrote it with an expert historian and two of my co-writers as well. So Emma and Gabby help with the script. So it's a sort of 15-minute little lecture with stupid sound effects that kids can go, oh, cool, now I know about Charles Dickens. So it's been fun to do, and we've had lovely feedback.
Good. Well, we'll check it. So that's all just available as a podcast online, the whole series?
BBC Sounds, we're halfway through the series. So it's called Homeschool History. So if you've got,
and
if you've
does
got
it count if you just get the kids? Because that's what, when I'm in charge of the kids, what I've discovered is quite a good thing when the kids are a bit older, Greg. This is a parent tip anyone can use. Just give them iPads and let them watch those. Then they're honestly, time passes by really quickly. My wife doesn't like it, but it means you can just do other stuff, whereas it's quite difficult. So I'm looking for things when I'm homeschooling that count, but that are really easy to do.
Yeah.
So that I can make them listen to that and go, this is homeschooling. 15 minutes. And in fact, if I do a few, could put out five or six. Then I go, it's your turn now, darling. I'm off now.
You've homeschooled them. You've absolutely done it. Yeah, well, I'm very happy for you to entrust your homeschooling to me. And
good. Yeah. I am to you as well. I wouldn't be happy to entrust it to myself, but unfortunately my family are stuck with... It's been very difficult. You're lucky your child's so young.
She is. She's unaware of the dangers she's in.
It's been quite good fun. And a lot of... I baked a loaf of... I've done a lot today. I've written some of my book. I made a loaf of bread.
Oh, very nice.
My kids made gingerbread men, which were very nice. It's fun. You have fun with these kids. They're crazy. My son's running around naked all the time now. What age did you enjoy being a nude when you were a young man? When I say young man, a child.
I don't remember being particularly nude a lot as a kid. There's a photo of me going up the stairs, I think, naked as a very small boy. I quite like being naked as an adult around the house.
I do that as well.
A bit inappropriate now,
I was nude till much too late. At home, much too late. And it wasn't 28 years old, but it was almost, you know, it was much like when people came round and stuff. I remember sort of.
Oh, no.
I mean, I think like 12 or 13. I remember maybe when my Auntie Jean came round, sort of scrabbling around trying to find some pajama bottoms or something. But I was basically almost a man. And my puberty came relatively early. So I think puberty may have convinced me to stop. But
right. I mean, Benjamin Franklin used to take naked. He called them air baths. So he used to say that it was good for your health to just get naked once a day and just sort of bathe in the sunlight and just walk about your flat completely naked. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. You know, it's not. When I lived alone, I probably did it a lot. But yeah, my sons, my daughter's a big advocate of it as well. They enjoy being nude.
Yeah, being free around. As nature intended. Yeah.
It's good. It'd be nice to be two again.
Do you think? I was trying to think the other day, what was the best age for just sort of the ratio of like happiness to lack of responsibilities to the ability to get the things you wanted when you wanted them? Because like obviously as a kid, you don't get to have the biscuits when you want the biscuits unless you steal the biscuits. And you don't have enough pocket money to buy the things you really want. But as you get older, the responsibilities increase. So where's the kind of happy, perfect place? I think I felt like maybe... I was a very serious kid.
Yeah.
I was like really, really studious and very, very grown up as a child. And then I turned into an absolute bell end. And I've never really recovered. And now I'm a total idiot and I'm very stupid. But as a child, I was very like sober and like, but why, Daddy? But why? So I'd like to think as a kid I had a lovely fun time. But apparently, no. Apparently, I was incredibly interrogative.
I've been pretty consistently the same throughout my life. I think four or five. And like my daughter's already five and I'm telling her she's passed the best bit of her life. Because I think like four, you understand if you can remember some of it and it's kind of fun and you can be childish and you can, I think the fun part of being a child is where you don't really get into trouble for being naughty because they people just go, well, he's four, you've got to let him. I mean, I was just so irritating. Like, I was always saying poo-poo, wee-wee bottom. That was my catchphrase. And again, I did it for...
That's your Edinburgh show, isn't
it? A long, I mean, it's my whole career, but I just literally go around the house going, poo-poo, wee-wee bottom, which is sort of, I'm getting paid. But my daughter is the same, but much more imaginative with her, the way she...
Right.
Her scatological humour is a lot about pooing in your face. The other day, both of them got on top of me behind my daughter, encouraged my son to put his bum in my face. And then she got up and tried to put her bum on my face. So I had both of them trying to put their naked bums on my face. And that's sort of, you know, it's sort of payback, really, for how I've lived my life. But I had to fight off two tiny, nice, but I like the enjoyable bum to have on your face. but very much the bum on your face as well. So it's it wasn't, and, you know. We're toilet training my son at the moment, which is part of the reason it's good for him to be.
Yeah. When my daughter was very small, she was probably about 8 weeks, she shat in my eye, which was really, really unexpected. Just one of those one of those kind of rookie moments where you just sort of lean in a bit close, you're changing the nappy, and she just projectile shat directly into my open eyelid. And I just remember being impressed. I just was like genuinely like, well done, darling. That's actually very good. Well done. I'm going to now go and wipe my face. But I was actually slightly moved at this profound moment of comedy. So she's
I mean, it's
done.
Very fun. There's a lot of fun to come, Greg. You're going to enjoy it. It's been fucking, I would have loved to just send my kids to Barnard Castle for a couple of days. Just let someone else look after them. But apart from that, it's been pretty good. I would have liked to. It'd be nice. I'm looking forward, most of all, just having someone come and look after the kids for a day. And which my wife is, as I've been working, my wife has taken on more than 50%, which I'm not happy about. I'm hoping that in a couple of weeks I can do the same for her. But it would be just lovely that neither of us have to look after the kids for just an hour would be nice.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact... You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Oh, that's all I care about. Oh, the question I wanted to ask you, you were on the podcast a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Has there been any new history since the last time?
Yeah. No, there's a couple.
Has there?
A couple of new histories. And,
okay, good.
They're pretty good, actually. They're all right. I mean, new history happens a lot. And obviously... depends what you want to call history. So you could say that Brexit, it was a historic moment, but was that history? Well, not yet. No, not really. I tend to say 20, 25 years is my happy little cutoff point. I think everything after that, I'm like, yeah, that's my territory. Hand it over. Anything under 25 years, I'm like, that's sort of journalism. So,
So a couple of years of the late 90s have become history since you were here last.
I think so. I think maybe... maybe some early boy bands in the 1993 era. Maybe early Take That. Maybe Take That have become history
Fist of Fun, maybe it's become Fist of Fun, my TV show.
I think you're probably passing into history now, which means...
That's good. I'd like to be.
The historians are coming for you. They're going to debate your legacy, and we'll find out if that show...
And I know you're a Tottenham fan, like Lord Sugar.
I am.
Have you tried this thing that this... If your age this year plus the year of your birth?
I'm not sure I'm a talented enough mathematician to pull off that kind of maths. I was born in 82, and I'm 37. 82. So that doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't work for you either.
No, but that's clearly my fault. Okay. I'm obviously not trying hard enough. And Lord Sugar, as a lord, as a former football chairman, as a man who fires people from jobs they don't have, he clearly has superior skills.
I mean, it's amazing to become someone as powerful as Lord Sugar and not and think that that's amazing, isn't it? I think there'll be on Twitter, tweets about it like sarcastically, and a lot of people are going,
really?
It's obvious. Even to the extent that some people were still bamboozled by it. So people are pretty thick, I think, is what we're learning.
I think, but also people, there's just lots of memes going around on WhatsApp, and they're all being shared by people like my parents' generation, who just share stuff without even reading it. And I remember like early on in the COVID sort of pandemic-y moment when we were aware that it was coming, but we hadn't really considered a lockdown. My mum sent me that kind of thing going around about, if you can hold your breath for 30 seconds, you don't have COVID. And it's like, that's not science. That's just a thing on the internet. And it was remarkable how quickly that spread through really sensible, educated people.
Yeah, I think something's happened to the late middle-aged people within this crisis. I've heard this again and again. I've experienced it mainly from my mother-in-law,
right,
who I love dearly, but I'm getting a lot of memes.
Yeah.
And I basically got a bit of spam from her about this. It looked like a thing. It was just a Word document. I said, this looks like spam, Pat. Are you sure this is? And she said, yeah, no, I got it from my friend. It's fine. And I stupidly clicked on it. And then I went, and then she sort of rang up and said, I've just been talking to my friend who thinks it might actually be spam. So, but then a lot of memes coming through that, as a 52-year-old man, I am not enjoying, but that she clearly, as a slightly older lady, is thoroughly enjoying. It's interesting. It's interesting what people will go for. And it's interesting that Lord Sugar, he's getting very angry with people telling him to delete it and that he's an idiot. he's not going. I think there's something gone wrong in his brain. It happens to everyone who hosts The Apprentice, apparently. So let's talk about your book. Here is your book. It is called Dead Famous. I can get the right camera there. Is that you've got one in the background there?
Looming over that's my
probably,
shoulder. Yeah.
Probably accidentally. Just the, that's embarrassing. It's just,
what are the chances?
And I haven't read it all, Greg. I would go as far to say I haven't read very much of it, but what I have read is...
I would go as far to say I've literally only just seen this in existence.
I've had it for ages, and it's been sitting on my desk over there for ages. I'm a big fan of your work. And the nice thing about this, though, is you can dip in a little bit if you want to, as well as read it. It's an interesting subject, and... How did you? It sort of came about by accident. I was reading in the introduction. It's near the beginning. How you decided you chanced onto this? You were writing a book about something else.
Sort of. So it's a history of celebrity, which it's a funny history of celebrity because everything I do, I try and be funny-ish. It's about where does celebrity come from? And I argue it starts in the 1700s, so it's 300 years old. And I stop in 1950 because celebrities after that, we know that story. We know Elvis and Marilyn. I was going to write a biography of a person who was born into slavery. He was a black guy called Bill Richmond who had been born into slavery in America, was liberated during the American Revolutionary War, and was brought to the UK and was given an education and became a cabinet maker, and then aged 40, decided to become a bare-knuckle boxer. His name was Bill Richmond. He became a big celebrity. He was really famous, and he taught Lord Byron how to box, and he knew the sort of Prince of Wales, and really interesting story, amazing story, and carried on boxing until he was like 64 years old. And I thought, great, okay, well, I'll write his biography, and I spent 7 years researching all that. And then I kind of realised, well, okay, firstly, I don't have time to write this. And then someone else wrote a biography of him instead. And it's really good. It's a book by Luke G. Williams. It's fantastic. It's called Richmond Unchained. But But I realized that I'd been calling him a celebrity, and I was like, oh, have I just made that up? Like, did they have celebrity in 1812? Have I just sort of superimposed some modern idea onto the past? Because actually, isn't celebrity quite recent? So that's the germ of it. That's the kind of basis point. But also,
no, it's a really interesting point again.
Yeah.
And the minute you sort of think about it, you go, well, that's a great question. But I would imagine as well, looking at it, the depth, the research you must have got, because are you the first person to ask this question? There isn't like it spans so many different people and so many different elements of fame. It must have taken you a long time to put this together.
Yeah, 4 years. So equivalent to a PhD. But there have been a few books on the history of celebrity. Of course, there have. Scholars have been writing about the history of celebrity for many decades, but they tended to sort of go, it started in 1910 with Charlie Chaplin falling off a horse or whatever. But in the past 10 years or so, historians have gone, no, we think it's older. We think it's at least 19th century. Some have said 18th century. And I agree. The book is my argument saying, 18th century is when it starts. But it was terrifying to start this book because I went in thinking this will be easy. This will be a doddle. Pretty straightforward. Quite a small subject. You know, I know what celebrity is. I'll just, you know, do a bit of Googling. No worries. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, incredibly difficult.
Well, it's quite difficult. It must be difficult to define what constitutes a celebrity, even, because, like, you know, you could say, you know, Julius Caesar's must have been a celebrity.
No, so he's not. So that's the thing. So he's in the book because he's not a celebrity. So I try and, you know, so I had to come up with my own definition because there's no accepted definition of celebrity, which is bizarre because we all know what it is. We all know, you know, celebrity MasterChef's on the telly. You're like, he's not a celebrity, which means that we have an implicit understanding of what a celebrity is. But there was no agreed definition. So I had to come up with my own. It took me eight months.
So why is Julius Caesar not a celebrity?
Whew, how long you got?
I've got a lot. You can stay here all night.
Right. Long story short, it gets quite complicated and the book explains it much more detailed and funnier. But celebrity is different to fame, is different to renown, is different to notoriety, and is different to glory. And they're all interlinked. They're very similar, but they're different. And fame was the ancient idea. So the Romans and Greeks had fame. And for the Romans, fame was a monster. So Fama, F-A-M-A, was a giant Godzilla-like creature covered in eyes, ears, mouth, and tongues. And she hunted you down. She stalked you down. And she found you. And she destroyed your life. So the poet Virgil talked about her as this beast. So the idea of fame as a sort of fun thing is actually quite surprising. But celebrity is different because, for me, the checklist that you need to hit, the 5 points to be a celebrity, and we can see if you're a celebrity on this checklist, actually.
Yeah, let's see it.
Number one, sure I am. You've got to have a unique personality. I think you do. Yeah. And there's no herring other than this herring. And number two, strangers need to know who you are. So people need to be able to recognize you and know your name, even if they haven't met you before. Number three, your name needs to be spread by the mass media. So there needs to be the involvement of media that shares your name out. I think we can say you've done that. Number four is kind of crucial. There needs to be a fascination with your private life, with what's going on in your sex life, who you're dating.
I've got everyone else is telling me shut up, so maybe I'm not.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that you would tick that box because I think you're sharing that stuff, but I'm not sure anyone's listening. And then the fifth point is the most important of all. There needs to be an economic marketplace attached to someone's fame that isn't just there to say that they can make money for themselves, but that other people can make money off them. So a celebrity is someone who has a parasitic economy attached to them, whereby journalists and bloggers and paparazzi and all that kind of people like that can make money by writing about the story or putting photographs up on the website of somebody else. So a celebrity needs to tick all five of those boxes. I don't think you do, I'm afraid. So you have what I call renown, which I think is better. So you're renowned. You're a renowned comedian and renowned podcaster, but you're not a celebrity, I don't think. But I think Celebrity MasterChef would have you. I think if you...
Yeah, I've done some celebrity. I've been in Pointless Celebrities.
You've done Pointless Celebrities? I mean, that's, you know, I'd argue their threshold is pretty low, but no, I'm kidding.
I'm one of the best celebrities that's been on there.
How many times have you been on?
Well, I'm actually just on my fourth, just before lockdown, I did my fourth appearance.
That's pretty good.
That one hasn't been out yet, so I can only talk about the first three.
Are you getting better with practice? If you can't talk about the fourth, are you getting better?
Out of the first three, if we take the first three, I've got one round further every time.
So that's
the
proof.
First knocked out, first round, second round, third round, and then you'll have to wait and find out whether that continued. But for that to continue, I'd have had to win the fourth one.
And maybe you did. Maybe you did. I'm looking for a glint in the eye here, and I'm not.
You should look for a pointless trophy in the background.
Yeah. Can we? No. Nothing
there. So that might be a giveaway. But I might have hidden it.
Celebrity is a phrase that we use all the time, and yet, of course, there are telly shows that have got celebrity in the title, where there are people on there. You're like, you're not celebrity, and that's not to say that they don't have great talent or great worth. It's just they don't hit the criteria of what a celebrity is. So the book is funny, hopefully, and surprising, hopefully, but it's a work of history. It's a properly, you know, there's 1,000 things in the bibliography, and it's, you know, a proper history book, but it's a hopefully a bit of a laugh as well. So it's fun. And there are people in there who are really fascinating, but there's also celebrity animals. There's Clara the rhino.
Yes. Yes, I saw that.
She was two tons of fun.
Do you think Clara the rhino... I mean, did she know she was a celebrity? Was she aware?
That's a great question. Was it Wittgenstein who said, you know, does a lion know if it's a lion and all that stuff? So I think Clara the Rhino probably wasn't aware of the fact that she was a celebrity, but she was probably aware that, like, she was changing city a lot because she was going on tour and she had a rider. She liked tobacco and beer, so she's a bit of a rock star. So I guess she... You know, she had a manager, she went on tour and she drank beer and smoked and stuff.
She must have noticed the other rhinos didn't have managers. She must have said, why have I got a manager?
There were What's no other rhinos. She was taking...
Why am I in a city? There's no other rhinos here. What's going on?
She didn't
Did she know there were other rhinos? Did she meet other rhinos? Rhinos?
She was a calf when she was brought to Europe from India. Okay. She probably didn't know many rhinos. So, yeah, she spent most of her life being the only rhino. So
thinking she was a really weird person.
Yeah, maybe.
Just think, why is everyone else not look like? I mean, maybe she didn't know what she looked like. Probably didn't have mirrors, so just assumed she was a person.
They did have mirrors.
Just thought I must be pretty.
She might have assumed she was a person.
They didn't have mirrors in those days, Greg. You don't know anything about history.
They did have mirrors in those days.
They didn't have rhino mirrors. They didn't have a mirror big enough to see a rhino in.
There's one of the guys who invented roller skates, if I remember rightly, was called, I think his name was John Joseph Merlin, I think it was. And he was, one of the things he did, he was trying to roller skate around a dinner party while playing violin, and he smashed into a mirror and very nearly killed himself. So that was in the 18th century. So, so yes, they did have mirrors because people were.
Well, they did. They broke the bloke skating into and broke it.
Yeah, well,
so
maybe.
There wasn't. That was the only one. Maybe. You never know. So who do you pin down as being the first celebrity?
I pin him down. I put my bum on his face. And
you should. You need to second bum.
The earliest celebrity in my book is a weird one. He's called Dr. Henry Sacheverell, and he was a conservative churchman. He was a kind of furious Tory in a poodle wig. And in 1709, he gave a speech in St. Paul's Cathedral saying the Church of England had gone soft and that the Whig government of Queen Anne was, you know, namby-pamby lefties, and he divided the nation down the middle and became this huge star. People named their babies after him. He posed for 20 different paintings. There were pubs named after him. There were riots named after him. He was paraded through the streets with an armed bodyguard. He was sort of the Nigel Farage of 1709, and he helped decide the election of 1710. He told people how to vote, and the Tories won a landslide. So he's the kind of first celebrity of that period, and it's a surprising one because he's when you look at the paintings of him, he's sort of this grumpy Tory in a kind of poodle wig, sort of going, what do you want? And he's not at all the kind of sexy, you know, top off bikini model or whatever. It's a totally different kind of thing. But celebrity is an economic system. It's not just about glamorous people with nice teeth.
Yes. And so one of the things you talk about in the book is the kind of phenomenon of being famous for being famous, which feels like a modern thing, but you're arguing that is not modern.
It goes back to the 18th century. There was a book written in 1786 called The Age of Genius that complained that there were celebrities out there who didn't do anything. They had no talent. They were just famous for being famous. Casanova was one of them. So Giacomo Casanova is now known as a sort of international shagmeister, you know, sort of toured Europe just bonking, but he was desperate to be famous. He sort of hunted fame down, and he sort of tried all sorts of different routes to it. He had a famous duel. He tried to be a sort of famous conversationalist, which was a job you could do in the 18th century. Just really, I guess, podcaster. I guess it's 18th century podcaster. He was sort of known for his fashion taste, and he toured around Italy, went to France, he was in England and so forth. He, you know, he really, really wanted to be famous. So he did all he could to make it, and then wrote his memoirs. Actually the complaint, the, you know, this idea of famous being famous is a complaint that comes from the 1960s by a guy called Daniel J. Boorstin. But actually, it had been there in the 18th century. The romantic poets complained about it. So, sort of, you know, Keats, Shelley, Byron, Wordsworth, people like that, they're whinging about these sort of, these blooming celebrities. You've got no real talent. What we're looking for is proper, glorious fame that will live long after, you know, we'll die, but our poetry will live eternal. It's an interesting one, actually, that celebrity, in all the ways we think of it, is 300 years old.
Yeah. And it's a weird phenomenon that people would covet it, and whether it's a, you know, I think it's so often not a good thing. I mean, that people still, even though so many people, I mean, you know, you see it now in the newspapers, but obviously throughout history, the people for whom it's destroyed them, or the people built, I mean, I presume that's a historical thing as well, built up, and then people, I know you talk about a very famous child actor.
Yeah,
who's built up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is built up and then tries to make a comeback, and no one's interested.
Yeah, so in 1803, Master Betty became a superstar age 12, and age 14, everyone was like, yeah, we're done with that now, bored, move on. Right. And he tried to have a comeback at 19, nobody cared. So he had this sort of two-year intense period of, he was sort of Macaulay Culkin of the 19th century. There were celebrities who were destroyed by fame, and it's, you know, some genuinely horrible stories in the book, you know, because it's a funny book, but there are some sad stories in there where you have to sort of kind of go, okay, this bit's really sad, sorry. So people like Brenda Fraser, who was a socialite in the 1930s in America, and she was made famous because she had a rich daddy. And her life just fell apart. It was just horrible. Evelyn Nesbit, her life is just traumatic and horrible in many, many ways. And then you've got people like Grace Darling, who is a hero, you know, heroine. She saved people from drowning, you know, up in Northumbria. She rowed out with her dad to save people from a shipwreck. And she was turned into a heroine by the media. And people just wrote to her and turned up at her house and knocked on the door. She went partially bald because people kept asking for locks of her hair, and she didn't want to say no. So she was sort of sending out like all her hair. And she just kind of became public property. And Florence Nightingale hated being famous. Like, she absolutely loathed it. Changed the name to Mrs. Smith when she was traveling, so people didn't bother her. She called it Fuzz Buzz, which I think is quite nice. There are lots of people in history for whom celebrity was like done to them without their will, you know, without wanting it. And then a lot of people who chased it down and were desperately wanting to have it. And then there are quite a lot of people in the middle who were like, well, you know, I want to do this thing. And if I get successful, great. Okay, lovely. So celebrity has lots of different permutations. It can be really glamorous. It can be really horrible. And it can be often sort of a bit of both.
Yeah. I suppose it's that weird thing that you're presumably feeling now talking to me, that it's, you know, being in the presence of a celebrity. I know you're the bloke off of a horrible history, so I'm very impressed with you too. But it's that weird, I mean, you know, that I still, if you saw the Michael Palin interview I did recently, when you're with someone that famous, it's sort of this, you're overwhelmed by it. So, I mean, you write about list mania with the Franz Liszt and people, women, you know, he's a rock star, women fawning over him and queuing up to have sex with him, but just trying to take anything of his to own. Is that a charismatic thing, or is it just, is it certain people that have that, or is it literally just the fame, the renown that makes people act like that?
Such a difficult question. Really, really good question. Yeah. And important one. Yeah. So charisma is a really interesting idea. It goes back a long way, but it keeps changing its meaning. So originally it's ancient Greek word charisma with K. It meant a gift freely given. And then St. Paul uses it in the Bible, and he's talking about a gift from God, grace gifted by God to people. But the 19th century, people are starting to talk about magnetism and mesmerism, and the idea that people have like innate kind of magnetic qualities that make other people drawn towards them. And then you get Max Weber, who talks about the idea of charismatic politics and leadership and people who can inspire mobs and crowds and whatever. But when you get to movie stars in the 1930s, they're trying to find their own language. So that's when 1933 they invent the phrase X Factor. And they also have the phrase oomph, which I think is a great, great one. So Marilyn Monroe was voted most oomphish at her school in 1941, which is a wonderful word. I mean, oomphish, I don't think I'll ever be called oomphish, but I can certainly aspire to it. So there is something inalienably weirdly fascinating about certain people. And what is it that draws us to them? Is it their beauty? Is it their gravitas? Is it their height? Is it the fact that they're successful? Is it, you know, Tom Cruise is a very small man. And yet, of course, if you met him, you'd probably be impressed by his stature because you'd probably be like, oh, it's Tom Cruise. He'd feel bigger. So what's that? What's going on there? Lots of people have tried to theorize it. Sociologists, psychologists, evolutionary biologists, all sorts of people have had sort of theories. But we don't know. We just don't know. It's just really interesting. And from a historical...
But is it to do with this? I mean, obviously, we're a social animal.
Yeah.
And we, you know, there were, I guess, the hierarchies within, you know, the tribe that we would have come from initially. So you have reverence for the leader, but also for people who are capable of doing something special within that. You know, it could go back to that.
There's a school of thought amongst sort of people who work with primates, chimps and whatever, who say like, well, you know, maybe celebrities a bit like alpha males and everyone else sort of desperately trying to look at what the alpha male's doing. And it might be that. It could well be that, yeah, we're used to living in small communities. You know, from an evolutionary point of view, we're meant to live in small communities, 100 or so, but we live in communities of millions, and we've been baffled and bamboozled by technology that allows us to assume that people we see on the telly are basically our neighbors, and we live in the same village as them and the same street, but of course we don't. So it ends up in a thing called parasocial intimacy, which is where you have a one-sided relationship where people know loads about the celebrity, the celebrity doesn't even know the person's name. So you might go up to a celebrity in the street and be like, oh my God, it's you. I love you so much. I know all about your, you know, I know what tattoos you've got. I know who you've dated. I know you had that breakdown. It was awful. I'm so sorry. All this stuff. And they might be like, hello, nice to meet you. What's your name? And that's a parasocial relationship where it's really one-sided, but it feels like friendship. And you can't call it parasocialism because that sounds like Lenin jumping out of a plane, but I like to call it parasocialism. But, it's a really fascinating, weird thing. And I've had a couple of, I'm not a celebrity and I'm not famous at all, but I obviously make a podcast and people are sort of vaguely aware of me now, which is sort of nice and sort of a little bit odd. But I've been at movie premieres for friends, where someone's done a photograph, a sort of selfie with them, kind of going, oh my God, can I get a selfie? And you kind of go, yeah, sure. And then the next person comes up and goes, hi, I don't know who you are, but can I get a selfie? And you're like, what? And they're like, well, that person got a selfie. I want a selfie. And I'm like, no, but I'm not. That was my friend. We were doing a selfie because it's my friend and we're at a thing and it's a fun night out. Hooray. They're like, yeah, but they're famous. And so therefore you must be too. So I've seen people actually kind of gravitate towards what they think fame must be, almost as if you get close, you can touch it and smell it and sense it. So they've wanted a selfie with someone they don't know who they are. Can I get your autograph? You know, it's like, no, I don't know who I am. Are you Joe Wicks? Yes, I'm Joe Wicks. So
I thought you were Joe Wicks when I got you on, but we've managed to bluff our way through. I've got an emergency question based on fame, which I'll ask you.
Yeah.
It's confused some guests, so I'm going to be very careful as I explain it. Who is the most famous person you've ever been in a lift with that you didn't get into the lift with? You might have got on the lift with them, but you weren't with them. You might have got on the same floor, ideally not, but you didn't get in with them is what I'm saying. Who's the most famous person you've been in a lift with?
Yeah, so who have you got into a lift? You've got into a lift and you've noticed a celebrity in there.
Yeah, that you didn't arrive in the lift with. It's a very simple question. I don't know why anyone would be confused by it.
I have been in lifts with quite a lot of famous people because you work in telly and film or whatever, you tend to just occupy.
Who's the most famous? Stop. The most famous. You should be able to do it.
All right. Well,
all about fame. You should know straight away who's the most famous.
Let me offer you.
Why.
Let me offer you some names, and you can tell me who's the most famous.
Okay.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Keira Knightley.
Yeah.
Jude Law.
Yeah,
the cast of Horrible Histories.
Yeah, that doesn't count because you got in the lift with them.
No, I didn't actually. I just met them. Stephen Fry, although I'm probably Steven Spielberg, isn't it?
I think Steven Spielberg definitely had that load of no-hopers.
But I mean, I once physically bumped into Scarlett Johansson. It came around a corner and hit her. And that was at the Brit Awards, and I was a student. It was years ago, 2004, I think. And so I came around the corner. I'd won a radio competition to go to the Brit Awards.
Bump into Scarlett Johansson. To
physically
to run around the corner and there'll be a celebrity around that corner. We're not telling you who it is.
And I came around the corner and I just hit this tiny, gorgeous, sort of elfin human. Very small, incredibly beautiful. But then two very large hands arrived on my shoulders and lifted me up and out the way. And it was her bodyguards, and they physically deposited me to the side. It was really great. And I just remember thinking, wow, that's what celebrity is. It's like this, it's like you can sort of meet someone, but you're removed from their space immediately. Get out, sort of airlifted out. And another thing, someone once asked me, what does celebrity sound like? And I know what it sounds like because I once accidentally went down the red carpet at an event that I wasn't meant to go down. I was allowed to go to the children's BAFTAs. I was allowed to go in. We'd been nominated, but I wasn't meant to go down the red carpet because I'm not famous. But I went down the red carpet, my mistake, and all the paparazzi were snapping, and they were snapping the people ahead of me. And the sound is this deafening, like just endless machine gun fire of like flash bulbs and men shouting, "Kira, over here, yeah, smile, for you." And I got there and they just put their cameras down. Utter silence, like just genuine, all you could hear is the sort of muttering of paparazzi going,
Well, you know the sound of not being famous. That's the sound of not being
but
famous.
As soon as I left there. Again, someone behind me, a TV presenter, came back and then suddenly... And so that's the sound of celebrities, the sound of machine gun kind of style paparazzi cameras, and then me turning up and ruining it.
And I know it is interesting, I think. I mean, it's a great topic for a book, and it's great to get that historical perspective on it as well, because I think most books would be about modern day celebrity. But I think I've always been interested in that balance, which Arthur Smith's talked about, the comedian Arthur Smith, is saying you just want a kind of certain, you want a level of fame where you get all the cool stuff, but you don't get hassled when you're walking around. Whereas I think Arthur Smith has exactly hit that, where he's got renown, as you would say, within his own industry. He gets work, he gets all that, so he gets quite a lot of the benefits of being famous, but he can absolutely go about his life.
Yeah.
Without being harassed, really, or someone might go, "Hey, Arthur, how are you doing?" And I go, "I'm fine," you know. But then that's his life. And I think if he's talked about that being perfect, obviously having viewed some of his friends become megastars and some of his friends not being, you know, not succeeding, it's always a weird thing where, because obviously you don't really have control over where you end up to a certain extent. I suppose if you become super famous, you could decide to opt out.
You could do a sort of Daniel Day-Lewis thing, go and become a carrot farmer or whatever it was, or a cobbler in Italy. I mean, that's an interesting point, actually. Arthur Smith obviously is really good at what he does, and he's not had to play the kind of celebrity game to a certain extent, and he's reached a level now where probably people in the street are like, hello, and the sort of nice, gentle wave. But then you get the opposite, which is the kind of, Beyonce cannot go down the high street. She can't go into Dixon's or whatever it is. Is Dixon's still going? Curry's, whatever.
Which I think it is.
Whatever.
I hope so.
And, I mean, 18th century celebrities had the same problem. So there was a very famous, very beautiful actress and poet called Mary Robinson, who complained in her memoir of not being able to go to a hat shop because people were just like outside the shop, desperately trying to get in to see what she bought. And there were celebs in the early 20th century who were very nearly crushed to death by their fans. One of whom, Florence Lawrence, was the first ever real movie star, first ever named movie star, because movie actors were anonymous before that, 1911. And her manager faked her death as a promo stunt. And then she turned up at this public event and people were so excited that she was alive, they very nearly killed her. So there's sort of irony to that. Quite a lot of the history of celebrity is actually the story of people enjoying the rise a bit, and then they're hitting a point where they're like, oh God, I can't go anywhere. I've lost my anonymity. I've lost my freedom. I can't even go to the shops anymore. People want to know what's going on in my life. Lots of 18th century actresses, people would just come into their dressing rooms to watch them get changed, you know, get dressed and whatever. And they'd be like, hi. And the people were like, hello, I just came to look at you. And so this idea of kind of wanting to peek into other people's lives goes back 300 years. And yeah, there's a hyper level of fame that you can hit, which is insane levels of fame, where you are the Tom Cruise, the Will Smiths, the Lady Gagas, where you are internationally super famous in hundreds of different places, you know, multiple territories, and where you basically have to go to, you know, the backwaters of Ulaanbaatar or somewhere in Mongolia for people to kind of go, morning, hello, without then going, can I get a selfie? But even now, these days, actually, if you go to Mongolia, I'm sure Lady Gaga is probably very famous. So
yeah,
that's really weird. But surprisingly enough, it's older than you might expect.
Yeah. And do you think from all this research, is it worth becoming that famous? Do you think there's more examples of it being a positive thing for people than negative, or do you think it's more negative?
I would hate it. And I think it probably attracts a certain type of personality. So, you know, Donald Trump is a celebrity who became president, and he clearly loves it. I mean, he's having the best time. I mean, even though he's a sort of horrific train wreck of a human and a terrifyingly dangerous man, he loves just, you know, the ratings of it. He loves knowing, like, is he trending number one? So he's very much kind of the Warholian idea of, Andy Warhol said, don't read what they say about you, just measure it in column inches. The idea that it doesn't matter what people are actually thinking as long as they're talking about you, which is, you know, same line that Oscar Wilde said, I think, as well. You know, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. I think there comes a point where celebrity becomes so intense that it inevitably probably fucks your brain and your mind, and you can't ever be a normal human again, probably. And then I think there are probably celebs who deal with it better than others, but like Madonna is never going to be able to go to the shops and just sort of go, oh, I think I'll have soup for dinner. It's not an experience she'll ever be able to have. And psychologically, she's probably incapable of thinking those sorts of things now, even though she's going to be a mum, she's a sibling, I'm sure, or whatever. You know, she's got normal relationships with people, but she just won't ever get to be like a human like the rest of us in that sense, because she is an icon. And sure. It's really interesting seeing what Beyonce has done in the past couple of years. Beyonce's just stopped doing interviews and stopped doing promo because she's reached a level of incredible fame and respect where she now just goes, I do what I like. And I've released an album. I've released it at midnight. I didn't tell anyone. It's just there. There it is. I'm just going to do a show. It'll be the sort of, you know, incredible show. It'll be the best thing on Netflix, but I'm not telling anyone. She's just become this incredible master of her own PR, and she doesn't even need journalists. So maybe she's, you know, showing us how it's all meant to be done. But I think celebrity looks like a pretty miserable existence, and I would hate to have it.
Yeah, it is. It's really bad. So it's awful.
Apart from going on Pointless, obviously. I mean, I've not...
getting on Pointless.
I'd love to go on Celebrity Pointless, even though I would protest that I'm not celebrity. But you know.
You could. You're definitely qualified, honestly. you're overqualified for the show. I'll have a word with Richard Osman. He'll let you on. I love it with, I mean, you're brilliant at this, and this is obviously what you do, but finding these little funny historical stories, I think it sort of does bring history alive. I think it's great for kids, obviously, yeah, with horrible histories and everything to make it funny, but also for adults. I think humor is such an important thing to put, and I think the humorous incidents within life, within history, are the things that bring it to life as well, and humanize historical figures. But I was really like the bit about Abraham Lincoln and why he grew a beard, which I was not aware of.
Isn't it good? Isn't it a cute story?
Yeah, it's really,
yeah,
good.
So the story is that Abraham Lincoln was a very smooth-faced man, very tall and quite weird looking. He might have had something called Marfan syndrome, which made him very sort of very long. He was running for office as president, obviously, and he received a letter from a girl called Grace Bedell, I think it was. And she was about 11 years old. She wasn't old enough to vote, of course, but she wrote him a letter saying, dear Abraham Lincoln, I think you're a bit weird looking, and I think, you know, my mum's not going to vote for you because you've got a weird face. Do you maybe fancy growing some sideburns? Or some mutton chops, it might hide some of the weird, which, you know, on the face of it, you're like, that's a bit rude. But he then visited her town specifically to go and meet her, and leant down, this sort of very tall man, leant down to this very small girl and sort of whispered in her ear and said, Grace, I've grown my whiskers for you. So clearly he took the advice of an 11-year-old girl and became, you know, Abraham Lincoln, the president of America. So I think what we're saying here is that all politicians should take their grooming advice from children.
It's incredibly is it secure or insecure? I'm not sure to go, oh, yeah, fine. I do look weird. In case other people think that. It's great, but lovely. Great stuff. And there's lots more talked about in this book, which you should read it. It's a very good book. Dead famous. Look at that. I'm going to read it all when I'm finished writing my own book. do you find that? I think writing books is the hardest thing.
Yeah, it's lonely.
Out of all the kind of writing jobs.
Yes. Yeah.
My one, luckily, is relatively short and a lot based on my own experience and things I've thought about already. So it's a bit easier. But to put together something like that, I think, you know, you're going to libraries, presumably, or surfing the internet. And
I get a lot of books sent to me from the library, which is nice. And then, yeah, I've read about 1,000 things. So the bibliography is quite long. But it took 4 years reading old newspapers, old magazines, old, sort of paraphernalia as well from the 18th century, 19th century, stuff like that. And then just reading loads of scholarship journal articles, PhD theses by academics and PhD students and whatever, and just trying to understand it. But yeah, I ended up with 1.4 million words of notes, which then had to be cut down to 135,000 words for a book. So it was sort of terrifying just going, how does this go in the book? I don't squeezing it in the, getting the, well,
and were you changing? So actually, again, the introduction, you talk about how on the first day of writing the book, you came downstairs to discover that David Bowie had just died.
Yeah, not in my lounge. That would
no, that would be good.
Shit, it's David Bowie.
You got the new, but that kind of changed, that immediately changed the direction the book was going to go in. So as you're researching these things, did you start with an idea of where it was going, or did that change as you researched it?
I was going to write a slightly snarkier, slightly more cheeky book, probably a bit more like celebrities, what are they like? And then on the very morning I started the book, literally 20 minutes into me beginning, like, you know, chapter one, celebrity, what is it?
What a load of cunts they all are. They're all fuckers. I'm doing well, I'm flying it. What?
My phone went dong and told me, you know, news update. I looked down and, yeah, David Bowie had died. And obviously this was a huge shock because in January 2016, he'd just released a brand new album 3 days before. So everyone was like, oh, David Bowie's got new stuff. That's interesting. That's great. Oh, I hope it's good. I'll give it a listen. And so everyone was expecting David Bowie to be like doing promo, doing tours, doing shows, you know, playing his stuff, and he was dead, and people freaked out, and they just, Twitter just lost its kind of all perspective. That was the only story going on Twitter. And so I switched on Lauren Laverne's radio show, and I love Lauren, she's amazing, and she just turned her show into a eulogy, and people were phoning in saying what David Bowie had meant to them, and the kind of genuinely moving tribute to this person who'd shaped so many lives. And then I kind of went, oh, bollocks, I've got it wrong. My book is, you know, a sort of snarky, cheeky, naughty history of celebrity. Actually, I can't do that. That's not right. Celebrity really means something. It's actually very powerful. It has a really important role in society. Oh, I need to take this seriously. So the book is funny. It's, you know, lighthearted and whatever, but actually I come down on the sort of side of saying the celebrity is not vacuous and a bit crap. Actually, it can be really powerful, and it can shape the ethical conversations we have, it can shape the kind of society we live in, the kind of rules we want to live by, the kind of people we want to be as individuals. So David Bowie's death was very sad, but it did actually give me a sort of a fresh insight into how I could improve the book without even having written it, which is nice.
Sure. Good. I'm glad. I'm delighted he died as a result. I'm glad, because otherwise the book wouldn't have been as good, you know, so I think he'll be glad he's dead as well.
I suspect that David Bowie would prefer to have been alive, but
I think anyone, or anyone watching this would go, well, it's better that he's dead. Greg Jenner's got a better book out of
it. I think that's what we're taking home. Adam Buxton loved David Bowie. I think he would probably be thinking, no, I'd rather have Bowie. I think he'd rather I had died. I think that's what I'm saying.
He wouldn't know. It's a difficult, I'll ask him next time he's on, but it'll be Sophie's choice for him. But you may go. I don't think I've asked you. I think this was an emergency question I've only started asking since you were last on.
Yeah.
But it's a good question for you. Forgive me if I've asked it before, but I don't think I have. If you could have one item if all the museums and art galleries in the world, and I'm guessing probably museums for you, but you are allowed to choose art as well, got together and said, we love Greg Jenner. We're going to let him take one thing home, and it's his, from any museum or art gallery of any kind. It can be something valuable. It can be just something that you're interested in. Which one thing would you take from all the museums of the world for yourself?
Okay. I would take the Bayeux Tapestry.
I'll
give you two reasons why. Firstly, it's incredibly important as a work of a glorious piece of medieval embroidery. It's not a tapestry, it's embroidery. And as a former medievalist, obviously it would be wonderful to have. There you go, there's a book there. By a tapestry right there.
Fantastic.
You know, I know exactly what it looks like. I'll take it. But the reason I would want it is that it's 75 meters long. I would unfurl it in my garden. I would then get a bucket of water and some gelatin. I would lace all the gelatin, throw down the water, and I'd use it as a slip and slide. on my belly, sliding 75 meters all the way to the death of King Harold. Arrow in the eye.
Wow.
And then I'd probably stop.
That's fantastic. The fantastic answer to that question. Fantastic. Brilliant. Look, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I know you have a young child, so I massively appreciate that. Are you doing more your Dead to Me's?
We'd love to. We are going to try and investigate if it's possible to do them remotely. Okay. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to pull it off, but we'd love to do more. It's such fun. And we're getting lots of messages from people going, please do more. It's you know, genuinely a sort of upbeat, fun podcast that is sort of helping me go in these difficult times. So it feels like, okay, we probably should. But it's a challenge because you kind of, you know what it's like. Getting in a room with someone gives you a kind of chemistry. And if it's a three-way conversation, it's a bit more lighthearted. And because historians and comedians are really similar, but they're also slightly wary of each other initially when we first sit down, because the comedian's like, well, I don't want to look like a stupid idiot. And the historian's like, well, I don't want to sound like a po-faced ass who doesn't laugh. So everyone's a little bit nervous to begin with. And I think sometimes being in the room together and eating biscuits is quite a nice way to do that. But
yeah,
we'll try and do it remotely.
Well, you know, we might be able to be non-remote again quite soon. You never know. But there's something for the remote chat has something to it as well. So I think it's sort of interesting to have this world opened up. I think even when we are back in theatres, I think I'll want to carry on doing some of them like this. It's also, you know, you can talk to people who you can't get into the theatre, which is quite a lot of people.
There's loads of historians in America and in France, exactly, and Italy. Yeah. I'd love to be able to get on the show. So, maybe we'll do it.
So it does sort of open up the world a little bit. And I think it's interesting how people are coping with this lockdown situation and where it might lead. And, you know, I think I'm sort of interested in comedy clubs being able to broadcast to the world, which I think they've sort of maybe realised that that's a possibility now, that you could still have the live comedy, but charge people in America to watch someone, you know, or anywhere, not just America, just in another town who couldn't make it to the club or can't get in. So it's sort of an interesting possibility, this liveness of it all.
Does that affect that affects the economics of tours, though, doesn't it, I suppose? So you'd have
But it would only I think it. I was thinking more. I mean, yeah, you could do it on tours, but also you could do it I think like the Stand Comedy Club. Quite a few comedy clubs are doing a live event, which is then streamed out, and most of them doing it for charity at the moment, but there's nothing to stop them actually doing that once they're...
That's true.
I guess you might think, oh, well, people won't bother paying for tickets, but I think people will want to see it live. But if you can't get to the Stand in Edinburgh, or any of the Stands, actually, are fantastic comedy clubs. If you live 300 miles away, you're not going to travel up to go and see that show. But if you might pay £3 to a month or a week or whatever to see what's going on.
Depends if you're Dominic Cummings, isn't it? If you drive to Barnard Castle to go see some comedy.
It does. But also, you know, lots of people can't get out, or lots of people can't get out in normal circumstances because they've got a family or whatever, or they're of work. So it's interesting that there's a whole untapped audience out there.
Yeah.
And I presume are you working on the next book or books?
I'm writing two books simultaneously at the moment. Which
are you allowed to tell us anything about them? Or are they just deadly secret?
Possibly. I'm not sure. Oh, I don't know. One of them's a kid's book. So I'm writing my first children's book. It should be fun. And the next book is going to be called Ask a Historian. Okay. And actually, I'm looking for people to send in questions for me to answer. So actually, maybe if people have fun questions, I'll be posting something quite soon on my Twitter that will be a little form. You can send in your questions. And it's just like, you know, send me difficult, challenging, funny, weird questions about history, and I'll do my best to answer them in a way that is vaguely accurate and a laugh. So yeah, two books at the same time is a bit of a head scratcher, but you know, it's nice. It's nice to be wanted.
It is nice. Well, and people should buy your book. It's available on audiobook. You do the audiobook yourself?
I did, yeah. It's fun.
That's another, I'll ask you this one more question. It's another slight emergency question. Audiobooks obviously are quite a new thing, and often the author does read them. If there was anyone in history or who before the times of audiobooks or even now who could get to hear reading their own book on audiobook, who would you like to hear the author reading their own book?
Their own book?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. So, I mean, you'd have to go Charles Dickens, because Charles Dickens famously was brilliant as a live performer of his own books. So he, during his second American tour, he earned something like £30 million during that tour. He performed all the roles from his books and read them in front of a live audience. And he got so emotive and exhausted in it, he had to have a lie down after every night performance. And he was sort of surviving on champagne and various sort of hardcore boozes. But he was this brilliant performer. He knackered himself to the point that he pretty much died 2 years later of exhaustion. Like, he absolutely burned through all his reserves of energy doing this tour where every night he was up there performing the death of, you know, Little Nell or whatever. So he would be brilliant. He'd be a very good audiobook reader. So
is there, I mean, so this is me showing my ignorance here. Was there any form of recording that crossed over with Charles Dickens' life? Would there have been any?
Not in his life. No.
Brief recording. No.
We have Florence Nightingale's voice. Right at the end of the century, right at the end of the 19th century, we have Thomas Edison.
Yeah, he didn't quite get to the end.
No, so he died mid-century, really. So we've got
We
have the voice of Florence Nightingale, which is quite it's quite scratchy and high pitched, but she's like, "Hello, I'm Florence Nightingale. I hope this voice is nice." And we have some sort of pretty interesting early sort of stars of like vaudeville and obviously Hollywood and whatever. Like, it's quite exciting actually to hear actual songs from like the 1910s and 20s, and you kind of go, oh yeah, it's all right, it's quite good. But no, Victorians are relatively thin on the ground when it comes to audio. Yeah. So
we got photos
and the book is a whole chapter on image and the history of image and technology of photography, because that's really fascinating. So
I always a fantastic read when I've seen your stuff. I highly recommend it. I know people aren't buying as many books during lockdown. It's time to start buying books, people, and getting out there and start getting back into reading. I'm going to read this one as soon as I've written my one.
That's fair.
If you're writing a book.
Yeah, I think authors are allowed.
I've got a pile about that high of books I want to read, but I can't do it at the moment, but I'm very much looking forward to it. The bits I've read are fantastic, and there's always just it's lovely to have humour, I think, in anything, and but also be learning stuff as well. So you're the perfect guy for that. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Pleasure.
I hope to see you in the flesh very soon.
Naked, and, like Benjamin Franklin.
On the other end of spit roasting a mouse. Sorry, a mouse, human mouse.
Spit roasting with who? With someone else?
Someone else is in the mouse is in the middle.
Yeah,
and we're spit roasting.
Oh, you and me. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
we'll work it together.
That feels like a whole other conversation.
Or the Neanderthal. We turned off. Right. This is us talking after it's over. You wouldn't do this with any other academic. I wouldn't do this with Mary Beard. I probably would. Thank you very much. Do subscribe if you're on Twitch. Remember to resubscribe. Thank you very much for all your follows and subscriptions. GoFasterStripe.com for all your Richard Herring needs and badges and blah-de-blah. Blah. We'll be back next week. We have got a guest for next week sorted out. It is Lauren Basson is on next week. He's a fantastic newer comedian. I want to talk to her about how lots of comedians are struggling to get any work done because they're not allowed to do comedy clubs anymore. She's working in a supermarket.
And she did the Mary Shelley episode of You're Dead to Me.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, yes. And really funny, really, really good episode, that one as well. She's fab.
Yeah. She is fantastic. She was on one of the Edinburgh shows as well, so you'll be aware of already. Anyway, thanks very much for watching, everyone. See you next time on Rahalastepa. Goodbye. Thanks, Greg. Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Rahalastepa with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Greg Jenner. Thank you very much to Pest for providing the lovely music we have here. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, for all his work in making this live stream work.
Remember, you can watch these live and free on twitch.tv/RKHerring on Wednesday nights. I would also like to thank my mum and dad for having me. I'm indebted to the executive producer for this episode, who is called Skegsis O'Rourke. We called him Smegsis O'Rourke on set, and we found that quite funny because smegma is what you get if you don't wash your penis. So, quite a clever thing to do. This is a Fuzz Go Faster Stripe.com and Sky Potato production. Head to gofasterstripe.com/badges to get all your badge needs. Go to Amazon or Waterstones or wherever you like and order The Problem with Men. And listen out for Relativity on Radio 4 and Ali and Herring's Twitch of Fun every Thursday night on twitch.tv/RKHerring. Also on your wherever you get your podcasts if you don't want to watch it happening, if you just want to listen to it. Thank you very much. Now go away.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to gofasterstripe.com for fantastic downloads and books and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, richardherring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.